This talk is called The Most Important Thing. You may have noticed that we're now 2 lunar months after Buddha Day. Traditionally, Dharma Day celebrates the first turning of the wheel, so to speak, the first turning of the wheel of the Dharma, which is the first time that the Buddha actually taught. And we've already heard the little drama that happened in the Buddha's mind, or well, dramatized by this meeting between the Buddha and Brahma Sahampati. So let's just catch up the period of time between the Buddha's awakening and that moment, just to fill in the story so far. So there is the man who now calls himself the Buddha, or the Tathagata, the awakened one. And he has had this experience or non-experience, whatever we choose to think of awakening. And he spends quite a bit of time in the area around the Bodhi tree. Tradition has it that he spends a week beneath different trees. So he spends 1 week looking at the Bodhi tree with gratitude. And different periods of time in different areas, having different episodes. So you might know the episode of Muchalinda, for example. If you go to Bodh Gaya these days, there is the Bodhi tree, or supposedly an offshoot of the Bodhi tree. And there's also different shrines round the grounds marking these different episodes. Anyway, so the final episode is this meeting with Brahma Sahampati, when we're told that the Buddha was inclined not to teach. It was just going to be too difficult. So I think we have to presume that the Buddha wasn't lazy, but he was just overwhelmed, really, presumably, with the prospect of trying to communicate something that's so subtle, so difficult. He says, "This Dharma is not easily realized by those overcome with aversion and passion. What is abstruse, subtle, deep, hard to see, going against the flow? Those delighting in passion, cloaked in the mass of darkness, won't see." So this is his experience of the Dharma, of what he's seen. It's abstruse, it's subtle, it's deep, it's hard to see, and it goes against the flow. So that's quite a significant point, I think. It goes against the flow. We'll try and work out what flow it is that it goes against. And then, yes, we have this intervention of Brahma Sahampati, however we choose to interpret that, in which he does say, there are people who can see this. They have but little dust on their eyes. And so the Buddha decides to teach, even though he's not actually clear at this point if it's possible to communicate what he's experienced, what he has seen. And so we have this moment where he tries to work out, who on earth can I teach? And his mind immediately goes to his first two teachers who taught him meditation, and he realizes that they're dead. And then his mind goes to the five ascetics, the five people he used to practice with. And he realized that they were dwelling in Sarnath, in the deer park in Sarnath, which is about 200 kilometers away from Bodh Gaya. So he decides to walk there. So this is why there's a bit of a gap between Buddha Day and Dharma Day. It's probably about 2 weeks walk, for starters. And it sounds like he wasn't in a big hurry. Anyway, so off he walks to Sarnath, which is very close to modern-day Varanasi, Benares. And this is quite a big encounter, the encounter with the five ascetics. I won't go into the full story there. Initially, they're a little bit dubious because who we now call the Buddha had fallen back from their way, that they'd He had dropped the ascetic practices, so he's obviously a bit of a backslider. Anyway, eventually he persuades them. Have you ever heard me talk like this before? There's something really imposing about him. And so they sat down, and they did a retreat together. We don't know how long this retreat was, but they sat together and the Buddha taught and taught and taught. And at some stage, one of them gets it. Kondanya gets it. He has this little insight. And the Buddha realizes it. And he says, Kondanya knows, Kondanya knows. That was the first inkling that this insight that the Buddha had could be communicated. There's a sense of jubilation. And in fact, all the gods, all the way up to the highest god realms, they're all jubilant, we're told. So this is the setting in motion, the wheel of the Dharma, the Dharma Chakra Pavartana. And there's a sutta that tells this story. And what this sutta tells us is that the Buddha taught the middle way between asceticism and hedonism, and he taught the Four Noble Truths, including the Eightfold Path. This is probably a bit of a retrospective retelling, because it's very likely that when the Buddha first started talking, teaching, all of these nice little neat lists weren't worked out. They were worked out later on. So we don't really know what he was talking about. But he teaches the Dharma, he sets in motion the wheel of the Dharma. And so I suppose we have to ask ourselves, well, what is this Dharma? We've got some sense of what the Dharma is. It's one of the most difficult to define words in the Dharma, is Dhamma. There are whole books trying to define Dhamma. It's one of the largest entries in the Pali English dictionary because it's got so many different definitions. But how about a quick definition being something like the way things are and how we should behave in relationship to that. So it's a description of the way things are and therefore the unpacking of how we should be in relationship to that. And over the years, this gets unpacked and unpacked. The Buddha teaches for 50 years. He unpacks it in loads and loads of different ways, works out loads of different lists, different practices. And then over the last 2,500 years, it's been unpacked further and further and further by more and more people until we have a veritable toolbox of different doctrines and practices. So here we are. I've bought my Dharma toolbox. Okay. It may look a bit old and rusty, but that's the nature of my Dharma toolbox. So I thought it might be useful just to have a quick rummage around in our toolbox to see what we've got. So what have we got here? We've got the all sorts of useful things. So we've got meditation practices for starters, haven't we? I mean, we've got the mindfulness of breathing. We've got the metta bhavana. We've got just sitting. In fact, we've got loads of others, you know, that's just for starters. We've got the rest of the Brahma Viharas, we've got Karana Bhavana, we've got Mudita Bhavana, we've got Upekkha Bhavana, and then, we're getting even finer here, then as we go deeper into meditation practice, especially as we ask for ordination, we've got insight practices, like we've got the six element practice, we've got reflection practices on the Nidana chain, we've got sadhana practice, and then we've got something which is a bit like just sitting, which is even more refined than just sitting, which I won't go into. Anyway, so that's just meditation practice. And then what have we got in here? Ooh, let's go back to me. There we go. We've got ethical practices, haven't we? There we go. We've got metta practice. that's actually, no, what we should have for that. I've got an adjustable screwdriver there. Metta practices. Here we go. It's suitable for everything, doesn't it? You can use metta practice for everything. We've got generosity. We've got contentment. We've got truthful communication. And we've got mindfulness practice. But mindfulness practice, really, what we've got with mindfulness practice is we've at least got four different mindfulness practices. Mindfulness of the body, we've got mindfulness of feelings, we've got mindfulness of mind, we've got mindfulness of dhammas. That's the four satipatthanas you might recognise, but then we've also got Sangharakshita's take, which is mindfulness of self, mindfulness of other, mindfulness of things, mindfulness of reality, for example. What else have we got? Here's another all-purpose tool. We've got everything to do with study and reflection. In fact, maybe we should have the mirror for reflection practice. This whole cultivating wisdom aspect of practice. With God. That's not friendship, is it? Here we go. Here's friendship. Friendship and communication. That's a whopper. The whole area of authenticity, of truthful communication, of communicating from our depths, of trying to be open and empathic to other people. That's a big one. What else we got? Then we got puja. We've got puja, we've got ritual, we've got recollecting the Buddhas. I really need some more things for this. We've got recollecting the Buddhas, and we've got mantra. Here we go. And there's tons more in there, as we have in our real Dharma kit as well. So I just want to give us a sense that we've got this very big toolkit of practices that we can engage with. And that is a marvellous thing, because it means that we can really engage with our psyche. However we find our psyche, whatever shape our psyche is, we can engage with it, and then we can transform it from head to toe, really. It's like we've got this working jalopy car, we're driving along, it's a bit cronky, and it's sort of backfiring a bit, and it's not very comfortable, but we've got this whole toolkit to turn it into this limo. There's a bit of a problem with that, though, as well, isn't there? Because it's easy to get a bit befuddled by the variety of different practices and Buddhist lists that we could be engaging with. For those of you on the Dharma training course, it's a 4-year course. And it just scratches the surface, really does just scratch the surface of Dharma practice and Dharma doctrine. We can try and keep too many plates spinning at once, or we can get really interested in... it's like you can do a PhD in a minute aspect of Buddhism, and we can forget the fact that these Buddhist doctrines, they are fingers pointing to the moon, they're all just trying to point to the moon in different ways. And we don't want to get too fixated on the fingers. What we're trying to do is use them to look at the moon, this experience that is beyond words. So we don't want to get lost in shelf loads of books. We want to put all this stuff into practice. So there's a whole aspect of... There's a slow aspect. It takes the time to work out how to really put the Dharma into practice in your own life. We've all got the task of trying to work out, what do I need to work with now? What's the area that limits me most? Or where's the area of greatest potential for practice? And try and work out a few ways of really applying that, finding our own coalface. And this is a large part of Dharma practice, is finding our coalface and working out how to practice there. And when we can do that, then we've got this delightful sense of potency, really, that I know what I'm working on, I know how to do it, let's just get on with it. There's a man called B. Alan Wallace, a Tibetan practitioner, who says, "What does it mean to practice Dharma? It is not just one technique, not just meditation. You can develop a repertoire of Dharma practices for every occasion. When you start to understand the richness and variety of Dharma practice, you will see that even if you are stressed out, tired, or depressed, you can still practice. You can become a skillful chef of Dharma, using its rich and varied recipes to make any situation into a source of fulfillment and happiness. When what you really want is to practice Dharma, you will find more and more ability to do so in a wider variety of situations." So I want to spend a bit of time spiralling around this, really. This whole issue of when what you really want is to practice the Dharma. How do we really want to practice the Dharma? That's a big question. And I also want to try and dwell a little bit on how do we do this essentializing? How do we boil it down into something that really works for us? It's quite a tradition in Buddhist stories that the disciples ask their teachers, just give me one precept, just give me one really essential thing that I can practice. And the teacher tries to sort of craft a precept for them that they can really take to heart. I did a long retreat a little while ago, and I wanted something that I could just hang on to keep coming back to again and again. And I came up with this little precept for myself, which was, work on whatever estranges you, me, from mindfulness and metta, with mindfulness and metta. So I just kept coming back to that. So there's an aspect of working in there, so I've got to work on whatever estranges me from mindfulness and metta, but remember to do that with mindfulness and metta. The Buddha's mother, or rather stepmother, his aunt, Mahaprajapati, asked exactly the same question. She said, it would be good, Lord, if the Blessed One would teach me the Dhamma in brief, such that having heard the Dhamma from the Blessed One, I might dwell alone, secluded, heedful, ardent and resolute. And so the Buddha gives this quite famous answer to her, which I'll paraphrase, which is basically, so this is like a kind of a litmus test for what is Dhamma. How do I know what really is Dhamma? And what he said is, it's not so much a sort of do this, but it's check out in your own experience, do these qualities, do they, on the one hand, lead to passion? This is raga, this is sort of unskillful passion. Do they lead to being fettered? Do they lead to accumulating rather than to shedding? Do they lead to self-aggrandizement rather than modesty? Do they lead to discontent rather than contentment? Do they lead to entanglement rather than seclusion? Do they lead to laziness rather than aroused persistence? It does a little list like this. So here's a list of things. If these qualities lead to these kinds of outcomes, that's not Dhamma. That's not what I've been talking about. If they lead to dispassion rather than passion, if they lead to being unfettered rather than fettered, if they lead to contentment rather than discontentment, to seclusion rather than entanglement, and so on, if they lead to these kinds of outcomes, that's the Dhamma. So it's like you don't have to have a canonical basis for what is Dhamma and what is not Dhamma. He's saying, just look at the effects, look at the effects. If it's helpful in these kinds of ways, then that's the Dhamma. So that's quite freeing, I think. It's not like this is a revealed religion that we've got to stick exactly to chapter and verse. It's asking us to use our own initiative, our own discernment. What effect do these practices have on me? But that's still not that simple, is it? Because it's very difficult to be honest with ourselves about and to have enough time scale to sort of assess what effect are these practices having on me? What's the effect of these practices as opposed to everything else that I'm doing in my life? How do I disentangle those? So I'm still circling around this question of what's the really essential thing? How do we really know we're doing it? There used to be a Zen teacher called Shinrō Suzuki, who was a contemporary of Sangharakshita's before he died. He started out teaching a little bit earlier in the States in the 50s, the San Francisco Zen Center. And he, along with Sangharakshita and a few other teachers, was really trying to translate the traditional language of the Dharma, of Zen Buddhism in his case, into Western language. And he was a bit of a trickster, was Suzuki. He was a bit cheeky with his teachings. And one of the things he liked to do is say, the most important thing, no one's saying, what's
the most important thing?
The most important thing, and they come out with all these different things, that the most important thing. So the most important thing is not to be dualistic. And then the next talk is, so the most important thing is to keep your spine straight. Then the most important thing is to forget all about gaining ideas. And the most important thing is to express yourself as you are without any intentional fancy ways of adjusting yourself. I like that one. The most important thing is this moment, not someday in the future. And there's this great big list of different most important things. So you're still left not quite knowing what the most important thing is. But I think there's something significant there, which is that the most important thing varies by the context we're in. It's pretty obvious, really. So when I was writing this talk, the most important thing was to reflect on what I wanted to say and not to check out Facebook. But then, when I was meditating, the most important thing was not to keep thinking about the talk. It was to be a bit more present in the body. And then yesterday I was with someone and it was getting a little bit late, and I found myself thinking, I really need to get back. And I was sort of fading out of communication a little bit and getting a bit impatient. And I thought, what's the most important thing here? The most important thing is to be present with this person and to communicate what's important for me. So I became more present and I said, I need to get back now, I need to finish my talk. So just that question, what's the most important thing, I think is quite a good way of orientating in any moment, because it varies by the environment you're in. And really, knowing how to do this, this is the same thing as what we call effective going for refuge, this language of effective going for refuge. If we can bring the Dharma to bear in any particular moment, especially the tricky moments, especially when we're up against it, if we can make the Dharma effective, then that is effective going for refuge. And theoretically, that is the point at which one can become ordained, join the order. Which I think is a bit of a tall order, so to speak. I feel as if I'm still on the nursery slopes of this one. Really trying to make the Dharma effective in any particular moment. So this is what Alan Wallace calls being a Dharma chef. Can we be a Dharma chef of any particular experience we're in? Can we blend just the right blend of Dharma spices? Anyway, so coming back to Shunryo Suzuki, there's one talk where I think he nailed it. He said, the most important thing is to know what is the most important thing. So that's it, isn't it? That's what the most important thing is. But then the question is how? How do we know what is the most important thing? So I was on a solitary retreat just over a week ago. And actually, I need to give a credit here to Vasantra. Just before my solitary retreat, I was on retreat with Vasantra. If you get a chance to go on retreat with Vasantra, highly recommended. And a lot of what is about to come came out of that retreat with him. So anyway, this retreat I did with him inspired me on my solitary retreat to do the going for refuge and prostration practice, which I didn't even mention, that's in here somewhere. So the going for refuge and prostration practice, if you haven't done it, is a slightly bizarre practice. So you visualize, you bring to mind this visualization of the Buddha and of enlightened teachers of the past and of the Buddha's disciples, and of Sangharakshita and his teachers, and of archetypal Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, and they're all sitting in a tree. They're sitting in something called a lotus tree, so for some archaic reason. So we visualise them all there. This is our lineage. And they're there in the blue sky, and then you chant a verse and you throw yourself on the floor in front of them. And you do that lots of times. This is the going for refuge and prostration practice. And I had this experience of doing this. I don't know if any of you have done this. I used to love doing this as a kid. I was really into magnetism. You get a needle. A needle normally isn't, it's normally not magnetized. And so you can hang a needle from a thread and it just points any old which way. But then if you get a magnet and you stroke the needle with a magnet, it slowly magnetizes the needle. And then when you hang it from a thread, it points north. And I thought I wanted to demonstrate that, but needles are only little things and you won't be able to see. So anyway, I bought my compass instead. Pre-magnetized. And had this experience of doing this prostration practice. Like each time I hit the floor, it's like another stroke of the needle. It's like I'm magnetizing this needle. Slowly, slowly, slowly. Getting this sort of inner compass needle to start pointing north. Start pointing in the direction of the refuges. Strengthen that sense of orientation, of inner orientation. And so what does this actually signify? What is this sort of compass? What is this magnetic force that we're trying to strengthen? And I think it's something like shraddha, confidence. It's our sense of confidence, trust in what is most deeply important, what is most deeply fulfilling, which is hard to put into words really, but it's like this sort of inner orientation of deepest value. And the thing is, if we don't have that, then the world will fling your little needle in any direction that it chooses to. There's a vast, vast array of people out there whose job is to grab hold of your needle. You just have to look on Facebook to realise the quantity of clickbait that is trying to attract your attention. Everyone is out there trying to attract your attention, attract your energy, and motivate you to act in ways that is profitable to them. And it's not profitable to us. So we need increasingly to strengthen that sort of inner magnetic force so that it points to true north and doesn't just get blown around by it's basically our own inner drives, our own inner greed and aversion aligning with other people manipulating those forces. And that's not easy. It's really not easy. So if we don't have a sort of well magnetized needle, and if we're still trying to practice the Dharma, which you know to some extent is all of our positions, we end up trying to do it with a kind of virtuous well meaningness. We try to, you know, we sort of know what's the right thing to do, and from time to time we can connect with that, and we feel our own inner drives pulling in a different direction, and there's a sort of inner tussle going on. And that's just the situation we're probably going to be in, to some extent or the other, is trying to work against our inner tendencies whenever we remember to do so. And the more and more strongly we can reinforce our inner compass, reinforce our inner motivation, then things just become easier and easier and easier. It's like we don't have to make such a struggle. We're not having to... it's just that inner force is starting to overcome the outer forces. So the most important thing, one way of talking about the most important thing, is to just really get clear about what we're trying to do, about the reason we're trying to do it, about the value of trying to do it. Really getting clear about any doubts we have. It's very easy, I find, to just fluff, to fudge any doubts. It's a bit uncomfortable to feel as if I don't have complete confidence in Dharma practice. And the longer you go on, the higher the stakes, you know, the more you've invested in this Dharma life. And the more scary it is to think, oh, maybe it doesn't work. If the kind of questions come up that, you know, my meditation practice isn't working, or that, you know, I'm not someone who can really get anywhere. Those kinds of doubts really need to be resolved one way or another. Because if we can really just be quite simply confident about what we're doing, be clear about what's really meaningful, what's really fulfilling in life, then that really simplifies our life. Do you know this four quadrant Stephen Covey time management tool, where we've got on the one hand activities that are urgent and non-urgent, and in the other case activities that are important and not important. And so you've got four different quadrants. Something can be urgent and important, urgent and not important, important and not urgent, and not important and not urgent. And if we're not quite clear in our mind about what's really important in our life, it's very easy to get drawn by what's urgent. There's so many things out there that are urgent. People will give you any number of different things that are urgent. And then there's all the things that are not urgent and not important, like checking Facebook, which is just sort of going with a kind of lazy flow. It's just a sort of zoning out kind of thing. Dharma practice, for the most part, feels not urgent, but it's important. Very easy to lose sight of just how important it is. If you're lucky, it becomes urgent and important. So I've had this a few times. It's usually really uncomfortable. It's usually a situation where you're brought right to the edge of yourself, things are really, really painful, and you've got to do something about it. And the only tools you've got are Dharma. And then Dharma practice becomes incredibly potent. It's just a shame that you have to sort of be brought up to the edge of yourself to do that. So this is why we come to the Buddhist Center, isn't it? It's to remind ourselves of what's important. We just have to keep on being reminded. I'm not telling you anything in this talk that you don't already know. But, you know, I take my job just to remind everyone of what they already know, just to sort of put a little highlighting pen along that important, not urgent quadrant. Anyway, so to come back to the trusty compass. So it keeps pointing north, doesn't it? It's funny, isn't it? Because depending on which way I'm pointing, the compass needle seems to keep moving. So it's like, depending on what I'm doing, there's a different practice to be done in order to walk north. But the north is always the same. So is there anything we can say about this north? Is there anything we can... I keep circling around, you know, what is this sort of most essential thing? Is there a way that we can really essentialize the Dharma? So I'll just spend the rest of the time trying to conjure this up a little bit. So I've already quoted the Buddha's teaching to Mahaprajapati, to his stepmother, about just look at which qualities, or just look at what qualities these different practices bring about. Sangharakshita has talked about it in a simpler way. He's talked about the taste of freedom. He's talked about, he's taken this from another teaching of the Buddha, where he says that all the Dharma has the taste of freedom. Just like the whole ocean has the taste of salt, so all Dharma has the taste of freedom. So there's one little measure, benchmark. Does this experience, does what I'm doing, does this view, does this attitude, does this practice, does this have a taste of freedom? Of course, it's quite easy to delude ourselves about this. I can lie in bed in the morning and think, no, I won't get up for meditation. And that can have the taste of freedom. And sometimes that might be genuine. You know, sometimes that might be genuinely the right thing to do. If I've been oppressing myself with meditation practice, that might be the right thing to do. But it might not be. So what is this freedom? What are we free to do, or what are we free from? And I think one way of talking about this is freedom from the constriction of ego clinging. freedom from the constraints of being self-preoccupied by me and my little world, which includes everything to do with sort of comfort, certain sorts of lazy comfort, and not stretching our comfort zone, and not stretching our awareness to include other people, to include the environment around us. So ego clinging has got this constrictive quality to it. So it can, we can get a bit deluded that something that is just going with the flow of ego clinging is free. But I think if we're a bit more genuine about it, and if we understand what ego clinging feels like, then we'll know that that's not the case. Because ego clinging has an almost sort of kinesthetic feeling to it. I think we can literally feel it in the body. It's a tightening, it's a constriction. It's not an opening, it's not an expansion. When I was on this retreat just recently, I've got this very busy mind. I call it an energized mind. That's my polite way of talking about my mind. It's very energized. And so I was sitting there with my energized mind, and I just started noticing, it had this feeling like this sort of plug hole, like this vortex, an inward flowing vortex. This was the sort of the kinesthetic feeling of what my mind was doing. All this sort of self-preoccupied thinking, it's just building me and my world, and reiterating me and my world, and this is who I am, this is what I like, and this is what I'm going to do, and this is what I've done. It's just like this sort of energy going down a plug hole. And this was at Rivendell, which is a very beautiful retreat centre, and it's got all these woods around it, and the bird life is completely bonkers. I had to wear my earplugs in the morning. The birds would wake me up at 3 o'clock every morning. And I just noticed, as soon as the thinking stopped for a moment, there's all this bird song. We've got a bit of wildlife locally, haven't we? And as soon as the plug hole of my inner thought stopped, suddenly there's this whole world. And that's got a taste of freedom to me. It's just much more spacious, much more expansive. It includes all of you. It includes the wood pigeons and the hens down the road and all the rest of it. So it's quite simple. It's quite simple in a way. So there is a later school of Buddhism, the Mahayana, which talks about Dharma practice as all just boiling down to this one point of reducing ego clinging, of just finding where we hold on, and to whatever extent we can, just loosen it, just relax it a little bit. And that might express itself very sort of physically in terms of generosity practice, in terms of being a bit more open to the person we're talking with. It might be in terms of just simply listening, being more present. It might be in meditation, just sort of relaxing this sort of vortex of thinking just occasionally, and maybe just thinking about other people for a moment. And this later tradition of Buddhism, the Mahayana, it talks about this in a particular way. It says that to reduce ego clinging, we need a couple of different things. We need compassion and we need wisdom. So the compassion is the inner compassion is. It's the moving outwards towards other people. It's the taking other people in to our world. It's operating, to begin with, within the perspective that we already have, which is one where we draw a line around ourselves. And we draw a line around other people, and we make a distinction. We've got the sense of, this is me, and you are other. It sort of starts working with that perspective we have, and we try and open out our own circle a little bit. We try and sort of overcome that inward vortex a little bit, and we move outwards. We try to become more compassionate. But it also works with this perspective we have. It works with the deluded perspective we have of drawing this line too tightly. The lines we draw between self and other, it's something we do. It's not something that can ultimately be found in reality. You know, at this very moment, I'm in you and you're in me. You know, but there's no hard and fast line. You know, we can choose to sort of draw a line, but there's nothing actually to be found. So that this wisdom perspective seeks to dissolve the delusion that leads to this inward vortex. So it unifies wisdom and compassion into this quality that's called the bodhicitta. The bodhicitta, the heart of awakening, the heart of enlightenment, the heart that's set on enlightenment. This movement, this sort of force that's just moving in the direction of greater and greater welfare for any being. So this is the true north. It's where ultimately where our whole motivational basis is aligned in this direction, and all it wants is for well-being. It just wants well-being. It doesn't matter who it's for, it just wants well-being. And that well-being is ultimately only found through awakening. So it wants awakening for all. And to the extent that we're in touch with that, then practice becomes very, very simple. We're not struggling against ourselves. We don't have to think what we need to do in this situation. All the practices start to have the same flavour. I've got a friend who is delighting in the fact that for him, although he does lots of different sorts of practices, they've all got exactly the same flavour. And this is after many, many decades of practice. But we've probably all experienced the mindfulness of breathing, the metta bhavana, coming together. You see how they don't have such a completely disparate quality. They've got the same flavour. We bring kindly awareness to our breath, and we bring a bit of attention, a bit of awareness to the experience of metta, and they start to come together. Yes, so this bodhicitta, this is something which has been treasured, valued, and cultivated down the ages. The thing of greatest value to the Mahayana Buddhists, at least. So I just want to finish with a reading from the Bodhicharya Avatara, which is a text that the Sevenfold Puja is based on. It's a text that rejoices in the bodhicitta and tells us how to cultivate the bodhicitta. So this is Shantideva, the author, who we presume is experiencing this bodhicitta as he says this. This is some verses of great uplift celebrating the marvellousness of being in touch with this quality. Today, my birth has borne fruit, and my humanity has been fulfilled. Today, I am reborn in the Buddha family, and I am now a son of the Buddha. And now I must live up to my birth, and by my actions must place no stain upon that spotless family. Just as a blind man may find by chance a priceless jewel in a heap of refuse, so somehow this Bodhi spirit is hidden even in me. It is the elixir of life, which destroys death, the destroyer of all. A limitless treasure to destroy all poverty. The supreme rest for the world's sickness. The supreme cure for the world's sickness. It is a tree of rest for the wearied world, wandering on the road of being. This bodhicitta, it is a bridge for all travellers passing over the waters of suffering. It is the heart's waxing moon, cooling the heat of passion. It is a great sun, dispelling the darkness of the world's ignorance. It is fresh butter, churned from the milk of the true Dharma. For the caravan of famished beings, blundering on the road of existence, it is a banquet of joy, which refreshes completely all who hunger for happiness. Today, I invite the world to Buddhahood and to all the happiness of the Dharma. May gods, titans, and all rejoice. And let's just sit for a few moments and then finish.